Today's episode is brought to you by Too Much Caffeine, ingested by me, one half of Crime and Theory.
And the other half is me, completely full of sugar.
You're welcome. No, it's really been too long since we've actually hit the record button, so I'm not even sure that I know what I'm doing anymore, so please bear with us, because it's been like a month and a half.
We are very rusty.
Vocal cords, memory of how to use technology. We've regressed into caveman status. Caveperson? Caveperson status. But I am glad to be back. How about you, Aaron?
Yes. Back in the game.
Dude, I can't believe we're almost done with season two.
That is insane.
We're almost a year old.
Aww.
Aw, little baby podcast is growing up. Look at this. I literally just pet the laptop. I'm sorry.
Man, it is hard to imagine it's almost been a year. Holy cow.
It's because 2020 has simultaneously been the longest and the shortest year. And we're recording the week of election week, so you can imagine how this week has gone. It's been long. So long. A week lasts a month lasts a day. This whole year is so backwards. It's like being at the Mad Tea Party.
And if you're still alive, listening to this after the elections, welcome to our show.
Well, I imagine that they're not dead listening to this podcast, unless they're ghosts. Possible. We do cover that here.
That's true.
But welcome back. And if you're here for the first time, welcome to Crime and Theory, a podcast dedicated to everything outside the parameters of normal. We are your hosts, Ashley.
And Aaron.
I wanted to sound like newscasters because it was like election week, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Get that vibe. I'm not sure if anybody can sense the different vibes, but...
Sense our vibes. We're vibing at you. We're not... I was almost about to say vaping at you, but we don't vape.
You're not Griffin McElroy. Speaking of McElroy's, the shirt that's like, thanks for vibing and keep it real or something like that. That's what I thought of when you were talking about vibing at you. Now, I was about to say, let's make a t-shirt that says, we're vibing at you, but it's too close. I don't want to copy anybody.
Nah.
When I finally meet the McElroy's, I don't want it to be in court. You know?
Yeah.
That's a bad way to start a friendship. But
though it would be neat to meet them.
Oh, I agree. I think a lot of people would agree with that. But guys, like always, when it comes to true crime episodes, because that's what we're throwing at you this week, I like to pick the most frustrating ones that I can find on the internet and, you know, present them. And by frustrating, I mean completely unsolved. At the time of this recording, so you're welcome.
Because unsolved mysteries are the best mysteries.
I mean, true. Look how old the show is. Unsolved Mysteries.
Yeah.
And that show's huge. But, Aaron.
Ashley.
Are you ready to dive back into a regularly scheduled program and cover this case?
Why, yes.
Sean Connery.
Oh no.
You did the Sean Connery voice.
My favorite dragon. It's gone. Rest in peace, Sean Connery.
I would say this one's for you, but this doesn't feel like a good episode to dedicate to somebody.
Maybe another one.
Sure. But this week we are talking about the murders of Keddie Cabin number 28. Let's get started. Well, now that we've gotten the awkward part out of the way, all sources for today are BuzzFeed Unsolved, TheLineup.com, crimeandinvestigation.co.uk, thoughtco.uk, allthatsinteresting.com, Plumas, news.com, and medium.com. It's a county in California.
Plumas?
Plumas? Pluma? I don't know. I'm going to say plumas. If you're new here, I don't English very well.
Plumas.
P-L-U-M-A-S.
Plumas.
See? So, this murder took place on the 11th of April, 1981, or sometime between the 11th and 12th, and the discovery was on the 12th. And brace yourselves, dear listeners, this one is riddled with possible corruption, missing persons, missing evidence, the works.
Everything that you come to listen to on this channel.
Basically. And this case is actually currently still being worked. Like, it was reopened in 2013, and it is still an active investigation.
Ooh.
So I want to preface that and say that by the time this episode comes out, new evidence could emerge. Who knows? We don't, clearly.
Wouldn't it be funny if by the time this episode comes out, it's now solved?
That would be amazing. It's only like 2 weeks from now, but still. Also, if you were alive in the Keddy area in 1981 and you know something, say something. Even if you're the killer, you've lived here with your freedom long enough, just do the right thing.
Turn yourself in.
Okay, now let's get started with this because we've got a pie in the oven and that's not like a euphemism or anything. We have an actual apple pie in our oven and I want to eat some pie because I'm controversial and I think pie's better than cake. Yeah, I said it. I think Aaron might want a divorce now. He's giving me the side eye. I'm kidding.
I think it kind of depends on what kind of pie versus cake.
True. Moving on. Keddy is a really small settlement in Plumas County, California, which is found on the outskirts of Quincy, California. So back in 1978, the small settlement area became kind of a big resort town. It's not big, but it was a resort town nonetheless. After kind of a revival, if you will. And Keddy Resort was built. And it was a collection of 33 cabins which people would rent out. Sometimes long term, kind of like how we rent an apartment.
Well, that's pretty neat.
It is kind of neat. And so check out how much it actually cost to rent for a month back in 1981. Do you want to guess?
I'm going to say, because cabins are really nice, it was probably just a little bit more expensive than the regular old apartment.
Well, give me a number.
In 1981.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go like $300 a month.
Nope. $170.
Oh, that's
not... Do you want to know how much that's worth today?
Yeah.
Only a little over $700 a month. And this is California.
Wow, that is not that bad.
Not at all.
Like, really not that bad for California.
Yeah. I mean, granted, it's not a big Californian city, so they can get away with having slightly more affordable housing and stuff, but that's still
now,
a really good deal.
Are they nice? Are they nice cabins?
Well, I mean, I only saw the outside, and just spoiler, I guess, because I've got it written way down in the script, but it was destroyed. Like, it was demolished in 2004. So, I can't really tell you if it was nice on the inside or not.
Oh. Oh, okay.
But it was big enough to house the woman in question and her 5 children.
Oh, well, at least it was pretty spacious.
Spacious?
Spacious.
True. I mean, it had a basement. It's not tiny.
Huh.
Yeah. I mean, either way, it wasn't a terrible deal at all. $700 a month for a place to live.
Yeah, in California.
Yeah, that's hard enough to find a place for that price around here.
Yeah.
And we live in the middle of nowhere. You found out where we live, guys. Nowheresville. Cue Courage the Cowardly Dog theme music.
Aww. I miss that show.
It was a good show. Anyway, this place had a stream where people could fish. There were trails where people could hike. It was considered a very safe location, so people wouldn't even lock their doors at night. It was kind of an idyllic area. It sounds nice.
It does sound
nice. It sounds like a place you could write a book about and stay to write a book in, if that made sense. Now let's talk about Sue Sharp. Glenna Sue Sharp was a mother of 5, as I said. And a relatively recent divorcee. when she began renting one of those cabins in Keddie in November of 1980. The family had moved from Connecticut. She had picked Keddie since her brother lived nearby. She was only 36 at the time of her murder, by the way, so she was still pretty young. And Sue had moved there to get a fresh start, and not just for her kids, but for herself. Sue's ex-husband had been in the U.S. Navy, and they moved around a lot, from my understanding, so after the split, I think she just kind of wanted to settle and provide some stability for her family. As you can imagine, if you haven't been in those shoes yourself, as a newly single mother, Sue kind of struggled to make ends meet for a while. She was receiving about $250 a month from her ex-husband, which is about $790 today. But think about it. She only had five kids.
Yeah, that's...
that's nowhere near enough to support five children.
Mm-mm.
But she was on food stamps as well and was on welfare. She was just doing whatever she could to provide for her family. Like, there was no shame in that, and good on her for doing what she had to do. But unfortunately, because there are closed-minded individuals, some people didn't see her as a good mom trying to provide. They saw her as, from the way it sounds, less than human. Sue was also in a federal education program, which gave her money to attend classes at her local community college in Keddie. Well, I don't know if it was in Keddie or Quincy or somewhere around there, but either way, good for her, because she had plans of trying to get on her own feet and do all the providing herself, and she was a strong, independent woman.
Yeah, I mean, it really sounds like she was trying to do her best. I mean,
for everyone involved.
Like, I can't imagine raising five kids.
I can't imagine birthing five kids. I can't imagine birthing one kid.
And trying to go to college or take classes of any kind?
Yeah.
That's
amazing, right?
Yeah.
And do you know what she was taking classes for?
Uh-uh.
Business. Her plan was to open a small business, make enough money so that she could buy a house that was big enough for her kids, that would keep them safe. Like, she didn't want to reach for the stars. She just wanted to have enough. She wanted to be comfortable, and she wanted to be happy.
Right.
And I think that's so nice. She didn't sound like someone who would really hurt anybody. She didn't want to take more than necessary. She didn't, and I'm not talking about being on welfare or food stamps. I mean, she just wanted a small business. She didn't want to own some giant Disney-sized corporation.
She just wanted to live her best life.
Exactly. I mean, I didn't know the woman. She might have been mean or something. I don't know, but it didn't sound like it. It sounded like she was just a woman doing her best to get through this life like the rest of us. I mean, even the way other people seemed to perceive her was that she was a pretty benevolent person, because by all accounts, Sue was a hard worker. She busted her butt at school to get good grades so she could, you know, graduate. She kept to herself a lot, so people kind of saw her as a bit of a loner, but she seemed pretty just normal. She was a normal human person. She didn't tend to engage in group studies or go out to coffee with her classmates or any of that, and even though she didn't hurt anyone, people still suck. They were still malicious. Because she was on a government assistance program, like welfare and food stamps, which, I mean, dude, she was literally trying to get her life on track. Give her a break. But people were so snotty about her. They thought that she dated too much, which is disgusting to me. The fact that those people thought their opinions mattered for anything. I really hope some of those people who thought that about her come across this podcast so that I can call them out and tell them what a douche they are.
She dated too much?
That was their opinion, yes. It was 1981. Remember, people were so old-fashioned. Because, goodness, Lord forbid that a woman go get a nice steak dinner with a person who's trying to get to know her. Scandalous. And then go have a burger with another guy the next night and see if they're compatible. Goodness, that's just offensive. Sorry, it blows my mind. They literally thought she dated too much. I don't know if that meant that they thought she was sleeping with too many people, which is also really nobody's business. That was her business. But given everything, I don't think she really had the time.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, how the heck do you juggle five kids and go to
school and
and make time to flirt.
So, exactly. So, it's not like she was going out to dinner with a different guy every night, if that's what she was even doing at all. I don't know. People just suck. People need to keep their opinions to themselves. Although, technically, I'm being a hypocrite because I'm giving my opinion about those people with opinions. I don't know. This is my podcast, though.
Yeah.
I can say what I want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go get your own podcast.
They also accused her of being a drug dealer and sleeping with men for financial gain. Also, when? When did the woman have the time?
That's what I'm saying.
And even if she did, again, her business.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you agree or not, her business. But luckily, Sue didn't seem to care. She just didn't pay them any mind. And she stayed focused on what she wanted to do with her life. And also, from taking those classes, from my understanding, she met a couple. And this couple happened to also live in the Keddy Resort. In a different cabin, of course. And this couple was Martin and Marilyn Smart. Martin was Marilyn's second husband. He was her current husband. She had a child from a previous relationship. I don't know if she was ever married to her son's father or not.
Gotcha.
Not that it matters. I was just saying I can't guarantee that he was her second husband. And her son, Justin, also comes into play in this story as a very important witness. But they became acquainted, whether they had classes together or they just met from living in the resort. They got acquainted. And they kind of formed a friendship. Sue found out that Martin, or Marty as he was called, was a real piece of work and was allegedly very abusive to Marilyn. I don't know if he was abusive to Justin or not, but he was not a kind husband to his wife. And it later came to light that Sue may have actually been counseling Marilyn to help her get away from her husband.
Oh.
Which says to me, Sue was a nice woman.
Yeah.
I mean, there were other rumors that Martin was cheating with Sue, but honestly, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
No.
Again, when would she have had the time? And if she did find the time, I want to know her secret. Not to have an affair, but I want to know her secret to have extra hours in the day to do stuff.
Time Lord.
Ah. Now, Marty actually was known to be involved in drug dealing, so that might be why people thought Sue might have been involved.
That makes sense.
Yes.
If, you know, if she's around him, they know what he's about.
Right.
Then a lot of people start assuming who you are around typically means you're about that.
Yeah. You are who you surround yourself with.
Right.
I mean, not always, but that's the consensus? Is that the word I'm looking for? I don't know. But regardless, Sue Sharp and her family seemed pretty happy. And before I get even further in, I didn't put this in there, but I did read somewhere that Sue's ex-husband was not a nice man either. So that might have been why she was counseling Marilyn, if indeed she was. Because she herself was in a toxic relationship and she didn't want another person to be in one. But the kids made friends in the neighborhood, and the two youngest boys were actually friends with Justin.
Ah. Huh.
Marty's stepson / Marilyn's son.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, everything just seems so normal, which is why this case is even more baffling to me. And Justin was actually present in the cabin on the night in question, the entire night. So, let's turn to April 11th. 1981. Remember I said Sue had 5 kids?
Right.
Tina, her youngest daughter, aged 12, and her oldest daughter, Sheila, aged 14, I believe? They were in cabin 27 that evening with the Seabolt family, watching TV and hanging out. Sheila was friends, and I guess Tina too, they were friends with the Seabolt's kids.
Okay.
Now, Tina was not allowed to spend the night. I can't remember why, but she had to come home. But Sheila, the oldest, was allowed to. So Sheila was not home that Saturday night. She stayed over in cabin 27.
So the oldest daughter was not present.
Correct.
Youngest daughter, or youngest child as well.
No, youngest daughter.
Youngest daughter, okay. But not youngest child.
No, not by a long shot.
Okay. She was present in the cabin.
In cabin 28. Yes, she went home.
Okay.
The oldest son, John, who was, I guess, the oldest overall as well, he had spent the day in Quincy with his friend Dana Wingett, age 17. So they were 2 years apart, but they were best buddies. And the two boys were last seen, according to record, walking along State Route 70. Real quick, side note, do you guys say route or route? I don't know. I just say route. Maybe I'm right. Maybe I'm wrong. We all know how I am with this language that I speak. Anyway, there's no definitive time as to when they got back to cabin 28, but it's assumed that they got home later that night. And when they came in, they probably went to John's bedroom in the basement. Witnesses claim to have seen John and Dana that night near the corner of Crescent Street and Lawrence Street in Quincy near the Gold Pan Motel between 9 and 10 the night of the murders. So it would have been pretty late when they got back.
And they have alibis.
John and Dana didn't need alibis. I'm just setting up the timeline.
Okay.
Of events.
So they weren't present.
No, they were. We're just setting up a timeline.
Ah, okay.
They were seen trying to thumb a ride, but that was the last time anyone saw the boys alive.
Oh.
Yeah. The two youngest boys, Greg, age 5, who was the youngest, and Rick, age 10, they were having a sleepover with their dear friend, Justin.
Okay, which
who
is...
I think was like 12 at the time.
Okay, so we've got her two youngest, Justin,
mm-hmm.
and the youngest daughter.
Mm-hmm.
They are present in the cabin.
Yes. Along with Sue.
Along with Sue.
And then Justin and Dana, not Justin, sorry, John and Dana make it home at some point that night.
Okay.
So given how late they probably got home, it was probably early hours of the 12th that the murders took place. But Sheila, the oldest daughter, slash the second oldest child, was not present that night.
Okay.
So we know she is unharmed.
Okay.
Okay.
So she is the only one that does not go back to
the cabin. That night.
That night.
Yes. And the three young boys, so the two youngest boys and their friend Justin, they were apparently playing and sleeping in an adjacent room to where the events of the night took place. Also, on this night in question... Well, the night of the 11th, Marty Smart filled in some of the events. Well, maybe, because he's not an honest guy, so we can't bank on it. But that evening, Martin, a friend that he had made some weeks prior at a veterans hospital named Bo Bubetti. Don't ask. It's a weird name, I know. If you had the last name Bubetti, I'm sorry. It's just, it feels weird to say. They had met at a veterans hospital because Marty was being treated for PTSD, by the way, because I think he served in the Vietnam War, which timeline-wise would make sense. And Marilyn Smart, they all stopped by Cabin 28 to invite Sue to go down to the bar with them. Sue said, no, I'm good. I'm going to stay here. And everything was fine. The other three left. They went to the bar. Sue stayed home with the kids. And apparently, according to patrons at the bar that night, or somebody, Marty and Bo were dressed to the nines. They were wearing like three-piece suits and sunglasses, and they were acting like they wanted to draw attention to themselves. It was very The Outsider by Stephen King. I know you haven't read it or watched it, but if you've read it or watched it, dear listener, you know what I mean.
But I mean, it's hard to imagine someone getting dressed... up to the nines. Nines?
Yeah, to the nines.
To go to...
A small town bar?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like wearing a prom dress to Buffalo Wild Wings. You know, unless you go there before prom, that makes sense. But
yeah.
I mean, me, a 30-year-old woman wearing a prom dress to Buffalo Wild Wings, that's weird, right? It would look like I was trying to draw attention to myself.
Yeah.
And the bar's patrons did recall that the men were acting weird, quote-unquote. Marty had apparently complained to the bar's manager that night about the music that they had playing, and they wound up escorting Marilyn back home. Marilyn went to bed around 11 p.m., and the two men went back to the bar for some more drinks, and then went back home again around midnight. I don't know why they traipsed back and forth to the bar so much, but it's what they did.
Maybe drugs?
I mean, maybe. But either way, just keep in mind that the men were awake that night. Lock that tidbit away.
Okay.
It's believed that around 8:30 p.m., Greg went to bed first, so the youngest. He was only 5. That makes sense.
That makes total sense.
Now, one article said that Tina was the next to go to bed around like 9:30. It was Medium.com that said that. Although, in another article, it said that Tina didn't even get home till around 10, which I don't know how you can tell who went to bed at what time when there was no one to tell what time people went to bed. I don't know. I mean, maybe so, Justin.
Really a he lives? Guessing game at this point?
I guess.
People went to sleep.
Basically. Now, Ricky and Justin, they stayed up with Sue to watch Love Boat that night. And she supposedly sent them to bed around 10. While she stayed up. Then around 1:30 a.m. on the 12th of April, a woman and her boyfriend staying in another cabin woke up to quote-unquote muffled screams. So they wake up, they can't tell where these screams are coming from, so they go back to bed. But remember, hang on, I see your face. But hang on, this is 1981 in a very safe area. It was not logical for them to think, oh, someone might be being murdered. I mean, today we would think that, absolutely. Think about all the true crime podcasts. Us. But back then, it wasn't like that. Times were safer. People were safer.
So, I mean, in my head, living in our time, I logically could not think of hearing muffled screams and not thinking something's wrong.
Right.
So I'm trying to think in their heads in that time.
What could they have possibly been thinking, though?
Could it be like, oh, it must, and, you know, I imagine it's children screaming.
I mean, that's possible. Kids tend to do that when they're playing. Or, this is right after the 70s, too. And, I mean, I don't know. I just read a lot of fiction and stuff. Not that kind of fiction with what I'm about to say. Please, I don't read that kind of stuff. But sex parties.
Right.
Were also a thing that people did. People still do that kind of thing today. I mean, it literally could have been a variety of answers besides murder.
But although, I'm thinking us,
we always think it's murder.
Or I'd assume in that time, they probably heard children screaming. They must be having fun.
Well, they didn't necessarily hear children screaming. I never said it was children. I said muffled.
Muffled screaming.
Mm-hmm.
Then someone's having fun.
If your first thought when you hear screaming is someone's having fun, are you okay?
I don't know. We should ask them.
We don't know that's what they thought, but I mean, they couldn't tell what direction it was coming from or anything. And I don't know. I don't know if the cabins had phones where they could just call the police and say, hey, we need a welfare check somewhere in our neighborhood because we're hearing screams and it sounds painful. I don't know. I really don't know what they were thinking. And it could be the mentality of, well, if I hear it, someone else hears it. Somebody else will take care of it. And that's an actual phenomenon.
That's true.
Also that night, people took note of a dog barking near cabin 28, and someone noted that their cats paced in and out of that home that night. Not cabin 28, but the cat's owner's home. The cats kept coming in and out like something was disturbing them. They were restless. That's the word I'm looking for. Restless. And I get it. Cats get restless randomly at 3 o'clock in the morning, typically. But it was odd for those cats. Because according to the owner, the cats usually slept pretty well. Probably gave them catnip.
Is it odd for that dog to be barking?
Not necessarily, but if you add it to all the other events, it might be that the dog was barking because they were alerted to intruders in cabin 28. Another neighbor also noted that the cabin 28's back porch light was still on at around 4 a.m. when it was normally off. It's not like Sue was working a graveyard shift somewhere.
Right.
So there wasn't a need to keep a porch light on at 4 in the morning. And, you know, like you were saying about the dog, those things individually don't necessarily indicate bad things. Especially since, you know, it was an idyllic area and bad things didn't typically happen. But when you piece them all together, it seems a little fishy. Then the next morning rolls around, and Sheila Sharp wakes up in cabin 27, next door. I guess next door or nearby. She walks over to her house because she's going to get changed to go to church with the Seabolt family.
I think my question is, I'm sorry to interrupt.
You're fine.
How far apart are these cabins for it to, I don't know, to make, for someone to say they heard muffled screams?
See, that's the thing too, that nobody witnessed anything. They were close enough together that somebody could have and should have witnessed something, but they didn't. I'll get to that. But they're pretty close together.
Okay. Well, these kind of look like they're almost right up on top of each other.
I don't know. It's odd. It is odd. But Sheila goes back home so she can change for church. And, well, let's just say she didn't go to church. She walked into the front door, as you do, and she saw the most gruesome and horrifying thing anyone could ever imagine. And you asked how close they were together. I literally wrote this part of the paragraph. Keep in mind that cabin 28 was in view of other cabins.
Okay, so there wasn't like any trees.
I mean, if there were trees, it would only be like one or two and...
Right, like not enough shrubbery or anything.
Yeah, it's not as though there's densely forested area separating each cabin.
Right.
And disclaimer, guys, I am about to probably give the most graphic description to date here on this show. So listen at your own discretion. This crime scene made me sick to my stomach. Okay. Are you still there? Okay, good. Sheila saw her mom, her brother John, and John's friend Dana laying on the floor. And it was beyond apparent that all three were dead. Her other brothers and Justin were unharmed. The 5-year-old, the 10-year-old, and Justin were all unharmed. So Greg, Rick, and their neighbor's kid. And I will get to the scene in just a second, but Sheila ran to the Seabolt's house, and she got them up. And a member of the Seabolt family in cabin 27 booked it, they ran to the lodge at Katy Resort, and they had the co-owner call 911, or call police. I don't know if 911 was a thing in 1981, was it? I don't know. I don't know the history of anything. But Sheila and possibly Zonita Seabolt, they got the three boys out of the house by having them climb out of a window so that they wouldn't track through the living room, kitchen, or wherever, and see the gore outside. So they weren't scarred.
Right.
At least to the most degree that they could have been scarred.
That was smart.
That was very smart, especially since she was only 14.
Yeah.
That was good thinking on her part. So police come, and here is what they see. It seemed like there was blood everywhere. Investigators found blood on the floor, the wallpaper, in one of the bedrooms, the living room ceiling, and spattered across the furniture.
My God.
I am not trying to be disrespectful when I say this, so please forgive me, but it was a bloodbath.
In multiple rooms.
Yes. This murder was so messy. And I'm just going to say this, for that much blood to be in that many places, especially to reach the ceiling.
Yeah, the freaking ceiling.
Well, you'll find out why, but there was a great deal of force used. And also arterial blood can reach that far.
Jeez.
Your heart's a powerful muscle, dude. Because what's happening is your heart's pulsing and the artery will shoot the blood. I'm not trying to be graphic or gross or disrespectful to what happened at that crime scene. I'm just trying to answer as to how it reached that far. 15-year-old John was closest to the door. He was laying face up, his hands covered in blood. The boy had been bound with medical tape, and his throat had been cut. His friend Dana was laying beside him, on his stomach. His head had been damaged as if he had been attacked with a blunt object, and he was laying partially on a throw pillow. He had also been manually strangled. So someone killed him with their bare hands. Or gloved hands.
Right.
But their hands. All three of them had also been bound with appliance cord, and I'll get to Sue in a moment, but all three had been bound with appliance cord as well as the surgical tape. And Sue was found laying on her side, and she was partially covered with a blanket. Now, one article from the lineup said that she had been covered with a blanket and a sheet belonging to Tina. The bottoms of Sue's feet and the soles of both boys' shoes were covered in blood. She had been gagged with a bandana and her own underwear. And she was unclothed from the waist down. Now, I did not find if she had been sexually assaulted, and I pray to God she wasn't. Her wrists and ankles had been bound with tape and wire. But that is pretty much the only thing consistent, is the binding with tape and wire. Sue had sustained injuries consistent with a struggle, and there was an imprint from the butt of an 880 pellet gun on the side of her head. Her throat had also been cut. Also from the article from the lineup, the 880 was not recovered from the scene, but I don't know 100% for sure.
You said that was a pellet gun?
Yes.
So
it was the butt of it.
You said that she had that imprinted on her head.
I believe so.
Okay.
So she had been hit with it.
Okay.
And if she did have signs of a struggle, then she fought. And I hope she fought with everything she had. Now, let's look at the crime scene for a minute. The reason that I gave... Well, the reason I gave detail was to give the details of the crime, obviously. But there's a lot of inconsistency with each person. Because Sue and John had a lot in common with their deaths, but Dana did not. Which, let's look at it. Two people had their throats cut. One was strangled with bare hands. Usually a killer, especially one in a rage, is just going to keep doing what they're doing until all the rage is out. This says more than one killer.
Yeah, it had to be. Like, I could not imagine, unless this dude is some superhuman, being able to take on three people. I mean, yeah, age gaps. But still, three...
Well, I mean, you had a 17-year-old, which is almost a full-grown physically human being.
Yeah.
You have a 15-year-old who's pretty close to a fully grown, fully physically grown human. And then you have Sue, who's a fully grown human, you know?
Yeah. Like,
and women aren't necessarily... women aren't weaker than men, necessarily. No. I mean, it's not a sex thing. There are some really tough people, period, out there. She could have been a very tough person. This woman gave birth to 5 children. I'm just saying, she was not weak.
So, I mean, it had to have been.
Because, and police did conclude that.
Because I was going to say, if it wasn't two people, either that guy just got bored using the knife.
That's not usually how it works unless it was completely premeditated.
Right.
And it was planned out and they had been incapacitated. But one person trying to incapacitate 3 people?
No.
I mean, 2 people could probably do it.
Yeah.
But I don't see one.
But I was going to say, like, or he somehow the knife got taken away from him and he couldn't use it.
I mean, maybe, but if it got taken away from him, then that person could have had that knife to wield against the assailant and survive.
Exactly.
See what I'm saying?
So, I mean, had to be at least 2.
All of the victims had received blunt force trauma from 2 hammers of 2 different sizes, which also says multiple assailants, and they all sustained multiple stab wounds, from what I read.
Okay. And one of them must have brought in a firearm for her to have.
You mean the pellet gun?
Yeah.
Which I guess is a firearm, yeah.
So.
But it was never retrieved. But yeah, I mean, if it wasn't retrieved, then that means they brought it.
Yeah.
And if they didn't bring it, they took it.
So, two different hammers, a knife and a pellet gun.
At least.
At least. That's a packing a lot of gear.
It's overkill, right?
Yeah, it's overkill.
Exactly. It was also determined that their bodies had been moved after the murders. So maybe instead of walking through the blood, because remember I said that the soles of her feet and the bottom, or the soles of her feet and the soles of their shoes, the boy's shoes, had blood on them.
Right.
So maybe they were dragged through the blood rather than walk through it.
Okay.
Because, I mean, even when you're asleep, you know how your feet kind of drop?
Yeah.
Now.
Were there any signs of them being dragged?
I don't know. Maybe.
I mean, that would be a pretty good sign to say that they were moved if there's signs of them being dragged.
Yeah. I mean, they had to conclude they had been moved after the murder somehow. So maybe. I don't know. But out of the evidence found, there was a steak knife on the floor. The steak knife had been used to stab so hard that it bent.
My God.
And I want you to think about this, and I'm sorry if this episode is just too graphic for you guys, but a steak knife is serrated. It's not a clean stab. It rips. It is literally a knife designed to rip through meat. Imagine the pain of that. I mean, don't get me wrong, a stab wound's gonna hurt regardless. But a steak knife, that makes my stomach turn. There was also a bloodied butcher knife and a claw hammer that police found laying right beside each other on a small wooden table near the entryway to the kitchen. But where was the other hammer that was used? We'll get there. But have you noticed in all of this that I'm telling you, something's just not quite right. Something or someone is missing. Sue had 5 children.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not counting Dana because that was not her child. So it was Sue, John, her 2 other sons in the other room alive. Sheila came back. Where's Tina?
So where did she go?
Well, the police put out an APB in Lassen. Is it Butte or Butte? I don't actually know because different words are pronounced differently. You know how we have Concord and Massachusetts has Concord. I don't know if it's Butte. I'm going to say Butte. Okay. It's B-U-T-T-E. And Sierra counties, and even in Reno, in hopes of finding her or any indication of where the killers may have gone. And the Keddie search and rescue team searched for her all over the area, but they came up completely empty. The APB described Tina as wearing blue jeans with a blue shirt, and having long blonde hair and a slight build. And I will throw in that this APB was not just for everyone to keep an eye out for her, but also for hospitals to keep an eye out for any patients who may have checked in the last 48 hours with possible knife wounds. Because they were hoping that maybe the killers would have sustained some kind of injury.
Okay.
Because think about it, the attacks were so violent. A lot of times that a killer goes into a rage mode, they wind up hurting themselves.
Really?
I mean, I can't give you a percentage, but it does happen. Because you're not being careful anymore. You're in a blind rage.
Right, right.
And they weren't using safety scissors, you know?
Mm-mm.
But try as they might to find Tina, it wouldn't be for another 3 years that investigators and remaining family members would have answers. At the crime scene, police found no evidence of forced entry of Cabin 28, nor was anything missing. But remember, everyone felt safe. People didn't lock their doors. There wouldn't have been a need for forced entry.
That's true.
But they do know that it wasn't a robbery because nothing was missing from the scene. They did, however, find fingerprints from a handrail on the back stairs, but they were unable to identify the one who left them. So that fingerprint just kind of sat there in evidence with everybody going, whose is it? And back inside at the actual crime scene, the telephone had been left off the hook, the lights had been shut off, and the drapes had been closed. Now, I don't know if Sue turned off the lights and shut the curtains so she could watch Love Boat with the boys. I don't know. But if the killers did it, that says they wanted to take their time. Mm. It wasn't just a rush in, do it, and leave kind of scenario.
Right.
And maybe they wanted to take their time, but maybe they weren't able to because Justin later told investigators that John and Dana had actually entered the home and argued with the men, plural, which confirmed the multiple killer theory, and that argument turned violent. And another thing that shows they took their time was the fact that they had all been tied up, and the two sharp boys had slept the entire night through. So somehow they managed to take their time, tie these people up, do the deed, and not wake up small children sleeping next door. How did this... I don't know where I'm going with this. I don't know. But remember Justin.
Right.
Because remember he said that John and Dana came in and argued with the two men, which means he saw something.
Now, it was Justin and the two youngest. They were in the cabin, correct?
Yes, they were the boys sleeping in the next room that I just mentioned.
So...
But I think his name was Greg and Rick. They didn't hear anything the entire night. Is that not odd to you?
That is odd. Like, how do you kill three people
with that much violence and not make that much noise?
Yeah.
I don't know. But Justin also told police that Tina had been taken out the back door, and that was the last anyone saw of her. And the person who took her out the back door came back in without her. Does that not mean she couldn't have gotten away unless there was another person? Or unless they put her somewhere that she couldn't get out? This whole case is bananas.
Like, maybe they tied her up too, but...
I mean, that's possible.
And stashed her in their getaway vehicle?
Maybe. That's possible. And I don't know if the killers knew that the kids were in the other room, or if they knew but they had no desire to kill the kids because they were small kids and thought that they were all sleeping. But Justin, like I said, he spoke with detectives. He actually said at first that he had a dream of what happened that lined up with how the crime scene was laid out and everything. A therapist said that he could have convinced himself it was a dream in order for his mind to protect itself, instead of actually having to face the reality that he saw something so horrific. At first, he told the police he slept the whole night. Then he recanted and said he dreamt the whole thing. And then Justin was later put under hypnosis. And he recalled seeing Sue with two men, as I said. One of them had a mustache and long hair, while the other was clean shaven and had short hair. He recalled that John and Dana walked in, they started arguing, and take it from there. Sue, John, and Dana were all still alive when Tina walked in. One of the two men took Tina out the back door to who knows where, and then came back in to kill the three. His hypnosis account was taken really seriously, which is odd to me, but I'm glad that it was. And a sketch artist actually drew up the two sketches of his description in hopes of some suspects coming to light. They also released sketches of two men, and I'm not sure if they were the ones described by Justin, who were apparently seen in Quincy the weeks before the murders. I assume that the sketches are the same. I don't know. Am I making sense? I'm so tired. Okay. Now, the sheriff at the time, Doug Thomas, he said, quote, "They're still not necessarily suspects, but they were around the area and vanished shortly before the crimes. They were seen by more than one witness," end quote. The two men were never identified, and the secret witness program that he implemented in order to have people call in and be anonymous about the whole thing in hopes of getting suspects, it fizzled out because people stopped calling in. Sergeant Stephen Wright stated later that, quote, "By the time a year had elapsed, we would react and investigate leads as they came in." So they were so few and far between that they would just jump on whatever and hope it panned out.
Oh, wow. So it sounds like these guys had, clearly they must have planned everything that they were going to do.
Possibly. Or whoever it was had people on the inside to help them get away with it. That is another possibility in this case, which I will get to. But police actually investigating the crime, they were pretty desperate, and they were grasping at straws for like anything and everything that they could get their hands on. They did wind up retrieving a knife from a trash can outside the Keddie General Store, and authorities do believe that it's linked to the murders, but not much else happened. And this might be significant, or it might be a coincidence, but remember Marty and Beau and Marilyn and how Sue may have been counseling Marilyn on leaving Marty? Well, the day that Sue, John, and Dana were discovered, was the day that Marilyn left her husband. But here's the weird part. And remember I said that whoever it was may have had people on the inside? Here's the weird part to me of what happened. Well, the weirdest part that happened close to the actual time of the murders themselves. Dear old Sheriff Thomas called the Sacramento Department of Justice, which doesn't sound that weird until you find out who they sent. Two special agents from the Organized Crime Unit. Nobody said anything about it being a mob hit.
So you're saying he sent two people.
The Department of Justice sent two people from the Organized Crime Unit. Nothing makes sense in this case, so if I'm not making sense, I'm sorry. I'm presenting all the facts, maybe not in the best order, but they're there. It was a murder, not a drug bust.
Okay, now I get what you're saying.
They weren't in the mafia.
It doesn't make sense for these two agents to be there because it's not their
jurisdiction.
Yeah.
Yeah, they weren't in their lane. Also, from my understanding, these two agents were known to be corrupt. Now, here to play devil's advocate, here's a reason that they could have been sent out of that unit. Marty and his new friend, Bo, they were both looked at as suspects, as we can imagine. Marty allegedly found out that Sue was counseling Marilyn, and he apparently went quote-unquote ballistic over the matter, and he was also a well-known drug dealer, like I said.
Makes sense.
Okay. And Bo apparently had ties to organized crime back in Chicago, where he came from, and he had financial interests in drug distribution. But was the unit sent because they were watching these two men and they were already banking on these two being the killers? Or were they sent to help cover it up? I don't know. A lot of people believe that these quote-unquote corrupt agents were sent to help cover up what was going on. Because Marty was also friends with a lot of people in the police, if he was indeed the killer.
Right.
So that could be why the killers never got caught.
And it kind of sounds like he could very well be at least one of the killers.
Who, Marty?
Yeah.
I mean, he would have motive, especially if he knew that Sue was counseling his wife on leaving him.
Yeah. Did they ever interview him?
Yeah. Well, they interviewed him because remember I told you that he gave an account of what he and Bo were doing the night of the murders. So he's looked at as a suspect. They had to interview him.
Right. But did they really, quote unquote, interview him?
Well, I mean, well enough, because, listen, he was interviewed, and Marty did something that seems fishy when you look at it, when you really look at it. He told investigators that he had a hammer, right?
Okay.
Now, investigators didn't ask him about the hammer. He just volunteered this information. And he said that this hammer that he had was missing, that someone took it, and this hammer, it matched one of the hammers determined to be used at the crime scene.
That's not suspicious at all.
No, it's purely coincidental. I'm gonna say it because I know Kelsey's listening to this episode. Say it with me, Kelsey. Coincidence? I think not. But yeah, do you see how fishy that is? He just, here, let me give you this information. Let me volunteer this information without ever being asked. Why would you? And to just really, you know, put the icing on this weird cake that he's a bacon.
Bacon.
Police hadn't made the whole hammer thing public knowledge. So if Marty was innocent, how would he know?
So, I mean, really, you know, getting my time of watching you watch Detective Conan, sit there and just get sucked into that show.
It's so addictive, right?
It is.
Mm-hmm.
That is, by all standards, a dead freaking giveaway.
I mean, you're not wrong.
I'm just saying.
I'm not arguing. Marty had told Bo, like, when they met, remember? Marty told Bo that, when they got out of the hospital, Bo could stay with him until Bo could get on his feet. So, of course, I'm going to say it one more time, Bo accepted And here's where the corruption part comes into play a little further. Bo and Marty would tell people that Bo had been a cop, and like I said, Marty had close ties with cops, and allegedly someone from the sheriff's department tipped the men off that they were suspects. And conveniently, just ever so conveniently, Marty and Bo both found work outside of California.
Oh my God.
It's just, it's so convenient.
But this mystery's never been solved.
But Sheriff Thomas told everyone, Marty took a polygraph test and he passed. Dude, the guy was a drug dealer. I'm sure he had a narcotic that could calm him the flip down enough to pass a polygraph.
Yeah.
Plenty of people would pass those things.
Did he really take the freaking polygraph test?
Also, that's a good question.
Word of mouth.
That's a good question. People really thought Sheriff Thomas was corrupt.
Did people see the report? I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm like getting angry about how obvious this is.
And, you're about to get angrier because there's also the whole thing where Marilyn stated that she woke up around 2 a.m. to see her husband and her husband's friend burning something in the wood stove of the cabin. So everything really looks like Marty and Bo are behind this, right?
Yeah. Like a lot of yeah.
Nothing's ever done. And in all of this, again, where's Tina? So 3 years after the murders, on the anniversary, in fact, in April of 1984, a tip came in. And this was an actual lead. Someone had found a skull in, again, I think it's Butte County, B-U-T-T-E, County, which was about 30 miles from Keddy. I read in another article that was like 50 miles. I don't know. I've never been to California. I don't have money. But the caller, and we would later find out when the case was reopened in 2013, the killer made a reference to Tina and alluded that it could be her. Somebody from 30 to 50 miles away finding a skull makes a call-in. Not because they found a skull, but they said, hey, this could be that girl missing from Keddy, right? 3 years later, that's their first thought?
That had to be...
It just feels so fishy!
Was it a man that...
I assume
so. Call in?
I'm assuming. I think it was a male voice.
Because that, oh my God.
But the police never investigated this call-in either. They never tried to find out who it was that called in this tip. Like, nobody looked into this until 2013 and beyond.
Couldn't they, I don't know. Did they have the tracing the line technology?
It was 1984. I don't know. We should rewatch Stranger Things and see how things worked in the 80s. I don't know. Sorry. Couldn't tell you. But regardless, they made no effort to find out. Nobody thought, hey, that sounds weird.
3 years later?
Yeah. I don't know. And investigators go out there and they find not only the skull, but a child's blanket, a blue nylon jacket. What color shirt was she wearing?
Blue.
In the APB. Mm-hmm. A pair of jeans. What pants was she wearing?
Jeans.
Mm-hmm. Now, these jeans were missing a back pocket. Not that these jeans were missing much, and that's a personal thing about women's jeans. Fix the pocket situation, people. Just fix it. And there was also, get this, an empty surgical tape dispenser, which what was used to
surgical tape.
Yeah. Also, Kelsey, say it with me again. Coincidence? I think not. The skull was positively identified as Tina's by comparing the teeth to dental records on file. There was speculation that Tina had been taken for sexual purposes, but it was not proven. And I don't know if anything else of Tina was recovered, just the skull. There may have been other bone fragments or what have you, but I don't know if they ever recovered all of her. It was determined that Tina had died sometime after November of 1981, according to the medical examiner, which means she was still alive the night of the murders. And because of the state of decomposition, her cause of death could not be determined. But it is widely believed that she was also murdered.
Right.
Just not that night. And if it was sometime after November, that's like 7 months. That's almost 7 months that she was alive and in custody of her captor.
Then they decided,
for whatever reason, to kill her.
Hmm.
What kind of sick freaks? And you know what? No, I'm going to take back what I said where it says in the script, because this is a direct quote from the article, that she may have been kept for sexual purposes. She may have been kept to have been raped. Let's call it like it is. She was a 12, I think I said she was 12, year old girl.
Yeah.
She was a child. And even if she wasn't a 12 year old child, if she was kidnapped and violated, that would be rape, regardless.
Yeah.
So chances are that not only do we have murderers, but child predators and or sexual predators in general. One theory as to who the killers could be besides Marty and Beau were the men who picked up John and Dana that night. But nothing, again, came from that investigation. So time passes and nothing happens. Beau winds up dying 7 years after the murders. And when he dies, he's back in Chicago. Then in 1996, a man named Robert Joseph Silveria Jr. was looked at as a possible suspect. He had lived in Plumas County during the 1980s, and when he was an employee of the county, people actually thought he was a pretty nice dude. But when he was arrested, he was suspected of 17 different murders.
Holy cow.
This guy had been a drifter, and during that time, over the span of 15 years, he would kill other drifters that came into contact with him. He wound up confessing to some 28 murders in all, which included the Keddie Cabin murder. So the police thought they had a break here. But he was only convicted for 2 of the 28 killings. And it was determined that he could not have been one of the killers at Keddie Cabin number 28. Because he was in prison that night for Grand Theft Auto.
Also, I mean, it doesn't... I mean, yeah, he's a killer, but it doesn't...
I mean, he's the killer.
Yeah, it's not the same M.O. He's a...
That's true. He killed drifters, for the most part. Yeah. And this family was not a family of drifters. So, I mean, you're right.
And I mean, if he's a drifter, that means he just keeps moving along. He doesn't stay in one place too long.
Right. I mean, he was eventually starting to grow roots because he became employed by the county.
Right.
In the year 2000, in Portland, Oregon, Marty died of cancer. So if Beau and Marty were indeed the killers, they're no longer with us. They will never be served with justice on this earthly plane.
And no deathbed...
confessions.
Confession.
Well, there didn't need to be a deathbed confession because... Ha! Hold on. In 2008, Marilyn Smart claimed that she suspected her ex-husband and his friend, which makes sense.
Makes a lot of sense.
And when the case was reopened, a letter that Marty wrote Marilyn was discovered. It said, quote, "I've paid the price of your love. And now that I've bought it with 4 people's lives, you tell me we're through? Great. What else do you want?" He literally said, paid for it with 4 people's lives. I bought it with 4 people's lives. Sorry. That sounds like a confession to me.
How do you... What was going through this dude's head?
Well, I mean, he was a pretty vile dude, so I can't really tell you.
You want to leave me, so I have to kill 4 people.
And Marilyn was not charged for withholding evidence or anything like that, in case any of you were thinking, oh, she knew about this. She claimed to have no knowledge of this letter. And she only found out about this letter because the authorities brought it to her. But she did confirm for them that the letter was not a hoax and was indeed in Marty's handwriting. So this letter is legit. Marty, speaking of confessions, Marty also had seen a counselor when he was in Reno, telling the counselor, quote, "I killed the woman and the daughter, but I didn't have anything to do with the boys," end quote. The counselor asked him why Tina didn't run away, and Marty replied that he had incapacitated her and that he had to kill her. Because she was a witness. Do you know what happened with that? When the therapist came to tell what happened, the Department of Justice dismissed the allegations as quote-unquote hearsay. Corruption.
on the highest level.
I mean, you know, maybe corruption. Don't sue us. Then in 2016, after this case has been reopened, of course, a man with a metal detector found, guess what? Guess what the man found?
The pellet rifle?
No. But you're on the right track.
The hammer.
The hammer. This man was out metal detecting, and his metal detector went off in a dried up pond near where the cabin once stood. And not only did he find a hammer, this hammer matched the description of the hammer that Marty claimed to have misplaced. Now, what's it doing there?
Huh.
And as of the time the article was written, it was being tested for DNA, but I'm not exactly sure if it came back a match for Marty, or if they are keeping the results close to the vest, or if they even found anything of actual use. I don't know.
Or are they even going to do anything
with it? No, they're on completely... The case was reopened by completely different people. It's actually being investigated now.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Because the people of 1981 are no longer in the same positions that they once were.
Good.
So, Sheriff Greg Hagwood, see, different sheriff. There's a new sheriff in town. Hey, that's accurate. And Special Investigator Mike Gamberg were the ones to run this investigation in the past 7 years. They both had good motivation to work hard on this case. Hagwood actually went to school with John and Dana, and he knew them personally, while Gamberg was their coach in martial arts.
What?
Matter of fact, Dana Wingate was even... Wingate? I'm sorry if I mispronounced his last name. He was actually at Gamberg's house the day before the murders. Gamberg was a deputy back in that day, just prior to the murders themselves with the Plumas County Sheriff's Office. For whatever reason, he wound up getting fired, but later reinstated. Sheriff Thomas actually kept Gamberg from the investigation. I don't know if he used the excuse of, you're too close to this, or whatever, but he kept him from the investigation. And any leads that Gamberg presented for this case were completely ignored. So we can kind of see why they believed there was a cover-up involved.
Definitely.
Now, Gamberg said back in 2018, I say it like it's a long time ago, back in 2018, that a segment of tape that contained DNA was found on the floor near Sue's body. They supposedly have matched this DNA to a living suspect.
What?
Living. Now, our two primary suspects are no longer of this earth. So.
But who's left?
We don't know. Again, I think they're playing this really close to the vest because they want to get it done right and they want to do it by the book. Because it's got to stick, you know? Now, Sheriff Hagwood said, quote, "It's my belief that there were more than two people who were involved in the totality of the crime, the disposal of the evidence, and the abduction of the little girl. We're convinced that there are a handful of people that fit those roles who are still alive," end quote. He believes that as many as six individuals were involved to some degree, from the murders themselves all the way to the cover-up.
God.
And if there were six people... That takes a lot to get six people coordinated for one night. Like, we play D&D. It's six of us. It takes a lot to coordinate six of us to play D&D.
Yeah, you're right.
Because you've got schedules. You've got an actual life, right? So, I'm just saying, these two men didn't just up one moment and say, okay, I want to go kill this family. Who's with me? You, 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 and you. And nobody was busy. Like, it wasn't a random occurrence. This was premeditated.
By multiple people.
Right. Most of the suspects wore gloves, according to the investigators. Identifiable footprints were not recoverable inside the cabin. None of the suspects seemed to have been injured or left their own blood at the scene. So, as violent as the crimes were, remember, they put an APB out for anybody who may have injured themselves for the hospital, the hospitals, to call in. What if there were more than two people in the cabin that night? Justin only saw two, but there were more than two people in the cabin. That would have been an easier way to incapacitate.
Yeah.
And if this was that premeditated, it wasn't a rage killing, and therefore the killings would have been more careful, and the killers would have been less apt to hurt themselves.
That's true.
But my question is why? why Sue doesn't seem to have been anybody involved in anything horrific, and why the kids? And why did they leave the little boys in the room to sleep? Why didn't they touch them? I'm glad they didn't.
Yeah,
I'm glad definitely. They didn't kill them, but at the same time, I'm just wondering why. And I'm sure they probably wondered why as they grew up too. But this investigation is almost 40 years old. And there have been some hang-ups and hindrances in this new investigation as well. The original case history log is missing. Gamberg has some hunches about what could have happened to it, but it has never been recovered. And some of the evidence was contaminated when the freezer it was placed in, so I'm guessing that it probably contained DNA and they were trying to preserve it, somehow this freezer got turned off.
There has to be. Man.
I don't think there was a power surge. I think this freezer actually got turned off, which says either someone's real clumsy or it was intentional.
Gotta be intentional. This is a big weavy web.
It's a conundrum.
Yeah.
And that is all I have for this case.
See
why I said I picked frustrating cases? Are you not frustrated now?
I am very frustrated.
See? Now, thankfully, there is that DNA that came back linking to a living person, so there is still hope to solve this case. But as of right this very second that we're recording, this case is still wide open. And this case really incited a lot of fear in a lot of people. And the people of Keddy started locking their doors at night. And I can understand why.
Yeah.
I personally think that Marty and Bo look like our culprits here for the actual physical killing.
But there
are more people. They're dead. And clearly there are more people involved here. So who else could have been involved? If Hagwood is right, then there are four other people to find.
That these four other people possibly work... If I've been following this correctly, that work in the police force to some degree, or have connections.
I mean, it's possible, yeah, that they could have been the ones to help kill. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm gonna keep a lookout for this case and try to stay as updated as possible. Hopefully, something will pop up soon, because these people deserve justice.
Absolutely.
I don't know. I think that no matter what the reason was, their reason was for killing Sue, it wasn't a good one. Because there's literally nothing I can think of that would have justified them killing her. And then killing those innocent people. Yeah. Dana wasn't even related to Sue. He just happened to be there.
I think that was the whole thing. He just...
And see, if it was Marty... Again, I don't know if Marty was abusive to Justin. We know that he was toward Marilyn, more than likely, but we don't know how he treated his stepson. But Justin was in the other room with the two younger boys that night, and that could be why they got to live, because Marty wasn't going to take Justin away from Marilyn, if they were indeed the killers. Now, I mean, Marty confessed not once but twice to two different people.
Right.
And he looks like a pretty good suspect here. I don't know. I just don't know. I'm aggravated with myself for picking this case. I'm sorry.
Well, regardless, I hope that the ones that are left, the ones that survived that night, get to see some form of justice in their lifetime.
I do too. I hope this case is solved. Aaron, do you have anything else you want to say before we go?
Stay safe.
Oh, that's what I was going to say next. Stay safe this week, guys. Don't forget to lock your doors. And as always,
don't get haunted.
We will see you guys next week for our Thanksgiving special / Aaron's birthday episode.
Whoop, whoop.